Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and our next call is going to be on October 3rd, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all of the participants we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the questions box your name as you entered it while you're logging onto the system and letting us know that you have a question. We will then unmute you and call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order when you submitted your name in the question box. And once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak for all of us to hear. Now, based on experience, a lot of you guys are shy, so we've also allowed you to go ahead and ask your question directly in the questions box. So just make sure you put your name on there and list what your question is, and we will ask that, or I'll read it out loud so Norman has it. So before we go ahead and get started, I do have a couple of announcements to make. We had our semi-annual event on August 23rd, a live 8-hour course. It's backed by popular demand. We've had a lot of requests from people that missed it, couldn't attend, different time zones, what have you. So we've decided to rebroadcast that event tomorrow, 8 o'clock here on the West Coast, Pacific time, 8 o'clock Pacific time, and we are offering it at no cost. So if you are interested in attending the rebroadcast, I'm going to be pushing a link to the events page, which will allow you to register for it tomorrow, 8 o'clock Pacific time for free. One more thing, there's a lot of the times we get questions about, well, now you guys are teaching the materials, we know how to do resolution matter, but how do I drive clients to my office? How do I grow my practice in that sense? So we are also offering on October 23rd, how to market and sell your professional services also for free. October 24th, how to market and sell your professional services, additional course for free. I will be pushing links to both of these events in the chat box. All right, so now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to the practice before the U.S. Tax Court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxing agencies. So, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everybody. We have a lot of questions today, so I thought we would just get right to them. Joe will read the questions. I'll answer them. If you have further questions, you can let us know online, and we'll try to answer your follow-up questions as well.
Thank you, Norman. So let's go ahead and just jump right into this. As a reminder, those of you who are members of the Tax Resolution Institute, VIP members, get priority over these questions. So when you submit them online, I check for your membership status and then put you to the top of the list. So the first few here are members, starting with Ray. Ray is asking, my client owns a mobile detailing business, an S corporation, and has employees, but is struggling to make the payroll tax deposits. He says, I know CNC is available for income taxes, but is that also an option for payroll taxes? If so, what can I expect from the IRS when presenting them with the company's financials?
So first of all, it's an S corp, so we're talking about a direct liability to the shareholder, and also that the taxpayers struggling to make payroll tax deposits, I would urge them to make those payroll tax deposits on time because the penalty is severe and it's just going to get the taxpayer deeper in trouble. So it's really important to make those payroll tax deposits on time. CNC, which is currently not collectible, would not probably be an option on payroll taxes for an S corp. So I wouldn't go there, but what's more important is to stay in current compliance. Again, with the making the payroll tax deposits on time, filing the 941s on time, and not having any additional tax liability. And what I would try to do is get into a small monthly payment plan. They usually have a limit on how long they'll stretch it out for payroll tax liability. But see if you can stretch it out for a year, divide the amount of payroll tax that the taxpayer owes by 12 and offer a monthly payment of that amount. And the IRS is going to look at a 433B, which is a financial statement for the company, to determine what the company can afford to pay each month in an installment arrangement. And it's really important because we want to keep the business going, and the IRS wants to see that it's going to get paid, and it doesn't want to be the way they see it, they're an unwilling partner in the business because the payroll taxes that should have been paid to them being used to pay other vendors and other creditors before them. So that would be my advice.
All right, Norman, thank you very much for that. Moving on to another member, Jessica. I just took one of your webinars and heard you speak on in business offers and compromise. Can you explain how this would work for a company with payroll tax problems? The company still has not been able to make their estimated tax payments for this year and continue to struggle. I want to be able to get them clear of their past liabilities so they don't go under.
Yeah, so that's the problem, is that you need to be in current compliance in order to submit an in-business offer and compromise. So if they're not making their estimated tax payments, then really an in-business offer and compromise is not going to be considered. So they need to make their estimated tax payments, and they need to be in compliance for at least 2 quarters. And then an in-business offer and compromise could be submitted, but only if they've been current for at least 2 quarters.
All right, Jessica, hopefully that answers your question. Another member here, Bill. Bill is asking, can you explain how the 10-year statute of limitation works on a payroll tax matter? Does it start from the filing date of the return by quarter or when the owner was determined personally liable?
Neither. So the 10-year statute on collection is 10 years from the date of assessment. So if it's payroll taxes, if it's the 10-year statute on collection from the company would be 10 years from the date that the payroll tax was assessed against the company. If you're talking about the owner, then and being personally liable, then we're talking about the trust fund recovery penalty. And again, that's assessed sometime after the payroll tax assessment. So it would be 10 years from the date that the trust fund recovery penalty was assessed against the responsible person.
All right. Next question here is from Paul. I want to request that penalties be abated for a longtime client of mine that did not respond to my emails regarding filing extensions or submitting organizers for this year's tax prep work. We did not file an extension and now has failure to file, failure to pay penalties, totaling about $3,600. Will this qualify for a first-time penalty abatement program? Has been a responsible taxpayer and this time just got ill.
So the nice thing about the first-time penalty abatement program is it's not based on reasonable cause. It's just based on giving one free bite of the apple. So it's simple to do, and you call automated collections and just ask them to run the scenario through their computer because they have a program to determine whether or not the taxpayer qualifies for the first-time penalty abatement program. And if they do, that penalty will be abated just based on that phone call. if they do not qualify for first-time penalty abatement program because they've been delinquent in the past, then reasonable cause is still a viable alternative. And if the taxpayer was ill and that illness prevented him from filing on time or filing an extension on time, and he has doctor notes or something to substantiate that, then you may qualify under the reasonable cause abatement. But that would be my second choice. First would be to attempt the first-time penalty abatement. If that didn't work, then I would use the reasonable cause to get rid of that penalty.
All right, Paul, hopefully that gives you a little more clarification there. Moving on to Jacob, also a member. Client owes approximately $350,000 and his housing is about $4,000 above the standard for his area. The revenue officer is disallowing the excess, creating more disposable income than what he actually has. Not to mention, the RO is also disallowing his kid's tuition. Have you encountered this before? Is there a solution here? My client cannot afford a payment of almost $10,000 and still be able to make his estimated tax payments.
Yeah, we encounter this every day. So the thing is, the revenue officer works for the IRS and not for the taxpayer. And so doesn't really tell the taxpayer all of their rights and everything that they could do. And technically, the revenue officer is correct in that if the housing is $4,000 above the standard, that they would just simply treat that as disposable income. And the same thing with the kid's school tuition. The kid's school tuition is a little bit more problematic because that really isn't allowed. And so it doesn't say how much it is, but you pretty much have to treat the kid's tuition as disposable income and apply that to some payment plan. But the thing with the housing is there's something called the one-year rule. And you could definitely use it in the housing situation and maybe on the tuition too. And what the one-year rule is saying is that the taxpayer has 1 year to get their expenses in line with the standards so that for a year the installment payment would allow the expense for the housing and possibly the tuition, but after a year it wouldn't. And so in that year the taxpayer could do some kind of financial arrangement so to blunt that effect. It doesn't say here whether the taxpayer is renting or buying the house. If they're renting, one argument could be, well, the lease expires in a year or whatever, and when the lease expires, the taxpayer will seek rental of someplace more in line with the standards and get that expense down. If they're buying, they may use that year to see if they can get a loan modification on the house or something else, or sell it and buy something less expensive. But the thing is, what the revenue officer isn't telling you and what you should look at is the one-year rule. And that should buy you a little bit a breathing space to work it out. I hope that helps.
And you're right, Norman. We do encounter that fairly often here. So moving on to Irma. Irma's asking, can I request to have a revenue officer transfer a case outside the client's local area? We are in South Dakota, and for this instance, we'd rather have an RO from LA or New York review my client's case, as I feel they will be more sympathetic to my client's lifestyle.
So there's something called the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights. And it says that the taxpayer has the right to, among other things, representation. And the revenue officer is assigned by either the area that the taxpayer lives or the area that the representative works out of. So the only way you're going to get this case transferred to an RO in Los Angeles or New York, if the taxpayer lives in South Dakota, is if the taxpayer's representative works out of LA or New York. Otherwise, you can't just, it's called forum shopping, and you can't just pick where you want your revenue officer to come from. I could understand because LA or New York revenue officer would be more familiar with higher expenses, but you can't just pick a New York or LA revenue officer because you want somebody who's going to be more sympathetic. So it really depends on either where the taxpayer lives or where the representative works out of.
And also they have to consider that the standards are going to be based out of where the taxpayer is domiciled. So we can't use standards for LA for someone that lives in South Dakota, for instance. Okay, moving on to Larry. Larry is asking for an IRS income tax audit. If the auditor is being slow, rude, and generally a pain in the neck, at what point would you consider speaking to the auditor's supervisor or even the IRS taxpayer advocate, or are those options just a waste of breath?
No, they're not a waste of breath, but timing is important. So the thing is, at some point, the revenue agent or auditor is going to submit an audit report with a 30-day letter. That 30-day letter gives you the opportunity to appeal it either to the revenue agent or to the revenue agent's manager. So I would wait till the 30-day letter, and then I would appeal it to the manager. And if that doesn't work, then what happens is the notice of deficiency is issued with a 90-day letter, and then you file a U.S. tax court petition within the 90 days of the notice of deficiency, and you can appeal it to the appeals office and go that route. So I really would wait until the 30-day letter.
All right. And Kyle, also a member, is asking, client wants me to file 4 years delinquent returns because he knows he will owe for these years and wants to file a bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins. You mentioned that there is a waiting period in order to do this. Was it 180 days from filing?
No, it's much more complicated than that. So first of all, it doesn't say which 4 years. So let's even assume it's the most recent 4 years. So the thing is, in order to discharge taxes in bankruptcy, there's basically three rules. The three-year rule, which means that the due date of the return, including extensions, has to be more than 3 years. So for instance, so we're in September 2017, and somebody who owed taxes for 2013 would mean that the return would have been due on either April 15th, 2014 or October 15th, 2014. And so 3 years from that would either be April 2017, which is already passed, or October 15th, 2017. So that would take care of 2013, depending on whether an extension was filed or not, and depending whether or not you file before or after October 15th of this year. But then any tax returns for years more recent than 2013 would not meet the three-year rule, so they would not be dischargeable. And then there's a two-year rule, which is it has to be more than 2 years from the date that the return was actually filed. And that kicks into place in situations like this where tax returns are filed late. So delinquent returns, it has to be at least 2 years from the date that the return was actually filed, regardless of when it was due. And then the 180 days has to pass from the date that the tax was assessed until you file. Because what happens is on delinquent returns, they kind of get to the bottom of the pile at the IRS, and it can take them quite a long times, 6 months, 9 months, sometimes even a year to process a delinquent return. So even though it was filed, it could be 6, 9, 12 months until that return actually gets processed. The other issue, which isn't mentioned here but could be a problem, is if the IRS prepared substitute for returns, SFRs, for those returns that hadn't been filed, then even filing them at this point after the IRS has prepared an SFR and assessed the tax based on that substitute return, the filed return may not be considered a return and may not be dischargeable, depending on where in the country you file. So I would get those returns filed, but I would do what we call a tax dischargeability analysis to determine when the taxes are actually discharged and wait until they're discharged before you file the bankruptcy. So I don't think that the taxpayer is going to be able to file bankruptcy as soon as collection action begins, because collection action can begin right after it gets assessed.
All right. Thank you, Norman, for that. Let's move on to Priba. Priba asks, I'm a CPA just getting started in tax resolution, and I attended a live event on the 23rd where Peter mentioned attorney-client privilege through a Covell letter. My question is, how often do I need to obtain a Covell letter, and what circumstances would they come into play?
So I'm a tax attorney, and I have attorney-client privilege with my clients. But there is no generally attorney-client privilege between a CPA and a client. So how a Covell letter works is a client comes to me, retains me as his tax attorney. We have an attorney-client privilege. And then I hire a CPA in order to assist me. And that Covell letter is a letter saying that that I'm hiring, even though the client may be paying the CPA's bill, I'm actually hiring the CPA to assist me because I need his assistance in determining some of the accounting rules and procedures involved in the case. I'm coming at it from a legal perspective, and the CPA is assisting me from an accounting perspective. So you would need some arrangement like that whenever you, as a CPA, have a client that needs an attorney-client privilege relationship, so that they need to hire an attorney, and then the attorney needs to hire you.
Got it. And Priba is mentioning the August 23rd event where Peter does touch base on this. So as a reminder, we will be rebroadcasting that event tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock here Pacific time. I'm going to push the link one more time just so you guys can get signed up for it if you are interested in participating and attending the full day 8-hour event. Okay, moving on to Andy. Andy's asking, can the trust fund taxes be discharged in bankruptcy?
The short answer is no, unfortunately. But there is something, and that is in a Chapter 13, trust fund taxes are a priority tax, and they need to be paid in full in the bankruptcy, and a Chapter 13 can go on for 5 years. So you're kind of forcing the IRS into an installment agreement that will pay off the trust fund within 5 years. And the other thing that's important is that if it's unsecured, then there's no post-petition interest accruing. So that could make a big difference. And so that all the payments are being applied to the tax, and the interest stopped accruing once the bankruptcy was filed. So there is no post-petition interest, only pre-petition interest. If there's a lot of trust fund penalty and the taxpayer doesn't qualify for Chapter 13 because of the debt limits, then they may qualify for an 11. And it would be the same kind of thing where you would be paying the trust fund through the bankruptcy and paying it off with no post-petition interest.
All right, moving on to James. James says, husband and wife clients have a joint tax liability due to the husband's self-employment status. If he files for BK, will the IRS go after her W-2 wages to recover the taxes?
Okay, so if husband and wife owe the taxes jointly, so it's joint and several liability, and if only the husband files for bankruptcy, then the tax is still collectible against the wife. And it doesn't say here whether or not they live in a community property state like California, but that would go into effect too, so that even if after the bankruptcy the wife still owes the tax in California, they could still go after the husband because of community property. So my question is, if they owe the tax jointly, why would only the husband file the bankruptcy and not the wife? And are they in a community property state or not? Because in a community property state, even if he just files bankruptcy and she doesn't, he still has to list her liabilities and her creditors in the bankruptcy because of community property laws. So I don't see the advantage for the husband to file the bankruptcy and not the wife if they have joint liability on the taxes.
Okay, now this is a question from Lauren, the last member on our list. Can you discuss the most common tolling events when calculating the end of the 10-year statute? I have a client who I think has passed the collection statute, but the IRS just sent in a garnishment order to his employer. Also, do you recommend software to do this? How accurate are they?
So the 10-year statute, or the CSED, is 10 years from the date of assessment. But it's told, by that we mean that the clock stops whenever the IRS is put in a situation where a collection has ceased. So the common events that cause the IRS to stop collection would be an appeal, like a collection due process, and that would toll the 10-year statute because the IRS couldn't collect while the appeal is pending. It's also it also tolls for the time between when a taxpayer submits an installment agreement request and the installment agreement is either accepted, or if it's rejected, then it adds 30 days for appeal, and then you would have the appeal, so that the time that between the installment agreement request was submitted and the installment agreement request was pending, and then it was either accepted or rejected. Another thing that would toll the statute would be if the taxpayer spends more than 6 months out of the country. So then that would toll the statute. Another thing that it would toll the statute would be bankruptcy. If the taxpayer filed bankruptcy because of the automatic stay, collection would cease from the date that the petition is filed in bankruptcy court until the bankruptcy is discharged or dismissed. plus 6 months. So it'd be the time that the taxpayer was in the bankruptcy plus 6 months. So those are the most common events that toll the statute. So just think of it, did something happen where the IRS ceased collection? Now, time that the taxpayer is actually in an installment agreement is not tolling because the taxpayer is making payments. And the time that the taxpayer is deemed to be currently not collectible, CNC status, is also not tolling. So that theoretically they look at currently non-collectible status, like let's say every 2 years, to see if the taxpayer's changed circumstances or not. And if they haven't and they get put into currently non-collectible status, they could run out the statute in non-collectible. So the easiest way of determining CSAD is from the transcript. If you look at the account transcript from the IRS, it will show any tolling event. It will show when it started and when it stopped. Software, we've had kind of mixed results with the software. We have a program that has software that projects the CSAD, the collection statute expiration date. And it's not always spot on, so that could be problematic, but you can get the transcripts. Also, if you talk to automated collections on the phone, you can ask them about a particular year. You can ask them, what's the CSAD, and they'll tell you the date. So if you kind of want to make sure that that statute expires sooner rather than later, then you might want to think twice about doing certain things that will toll the statute, like submitting an installment agreement request or requesting a CDP hearing or something else that will toll the statute.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. And yes, that software that we use is Canopy software. It's actually pretty good because it does generate a report for us, and all we do is double-check the numbers. So it pulls transcripts and then generates a report for us. So it makes it a little more easier. Staying on the subject of statute of limitations, moving on to John, who's a CPA. He's asking, I have a question regarding statute of limitations. My client didn't file his 2006 tax return. IRS assessed the tax on April 11, 2011, based on 1099s filed as he is self-employed. I filed his return on September 12, 2016, since the IRS didn't account for his business expenses. This reduces tax and penalties by over 50%. Does the 10-year statute of limitation expire on April 11, 2021, which is when the IRS made the original assessment, or the September 12, 2026, when after the date return filed is when he filed the return?
Okay, so after you filed his return, which replaced the SFR, then the 10-year statute began from the date of assessment. So if it's now the date that he filed his return, it's the date that the tax was assessed, which could be, like we said before, could be quite a while, especially on a return that is replacing an SFR. If you file a return after the IRS has filed their own return, a substitute for return, an SFR, then you should file that return at the ASFR unit in Holtsville, New York. And the problem is if you send that return to the same place that you send original returns, it's going to create problems and it's going to create delays. So first you want to make sure that you file a return that replaces an SFR in the correct place, and that's the ASFR unit. Secondly, there's going to be a lag between the time that you file the return and that they receive the return and the time that they process it and assess it. And you can see that on a tax transcript, on an account transcript. It will show the SFR, it will show the original assessment, it will show the date that the return was filed. They might call it an amended return. And then you'll see a date that the tax has been assessed and that the tax from the first assessment has been abated because it was reduced by the second return. And then you want to wait 10 years from the date of the assessment based on the second return.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Now moving on to Angie. Angie asks, if an individual statute of limitation has passed to claim a refund, can the person, instead of claiming a refund, ask to apply the amount to the next year as an estimated payment? A colleague of mine told me her CPA contact told her late filers can do that instead of letting the refund expire. For example, a 2012's late filing results in a refund. The taxpayer should ask to roll that to 2013 as an estimated payment and then the 2013 to 14 and then claim the refund in the first year that is still eligible, 2014 as of today.
Right, so there is a difference between a refund being sent directly to the taxpayer and a refund being applied to another year. But you have to be careful because if return is filed and it's filed several years after it was due, then even the refund on that return, you could lose and it could be applied, not be given back to the taxpayer or be allowed to be to offset tax owed on another year. So you really want, the lesson is you really want to get delinquent returns filed as soon as possible and seek the refund, but depending on the timing, that refund isn't always available.
All right. Thank you, Norman, for that. Moving on to Dana. Dana has a question regarding CI investigation. She just wants us to please discuss CI investigations initiated for failure to file.
Okay, so there would be two scenarios, and my answer would be different depending on which scenario it is. One would be that it's already in CI and being investigated by criminal investigation, or it hasn't. If it hasn't, I would go ahead and prepare those delinquent returns, and then you avoid criminal investigation because returns have been filed. Remember, it's not a crime to owe tax. It's just a crime to avoid filing or paying the tax. And the other thing is, if it's been assigned to CI, so then they're going to look at preparing, again, substitute for returns, and there'll be some penalties and interest and tax owed. But the thing is, you really want to be careful about preparing delinquent returns when you're under criminal investigation. And the reason is the IRS could treat that as kind of a statement as an admission of guilt. In other words, yeah, I didn't file them, you're right, and so I'm going to file it now. But if it gets to the point where it's actually been assigned to CI, then I would say that that's too late. And at that point, there's really no advantage to filing the return.
And just so you know, Dana and everyone else on the call, CI is a topic that is covered by Peter in the full 8-hour event. Again, we're rebroadcasting that tomorrow. So if you're interested, check the chat box. I've already pushed links to that and the other event that's coming up for free. Okay. Moving on to, actually, before I move on to the next question, I do want to, we're coming to the end of the pre-submitted questions, so there's only a handful left. So for those of you that are online, I see some of you have already submitted some questions, but please go ahead and start typing them in now, because it looks like we are going to have a few minutes after I'm done with these next few questions to pose the questions for you folks online. So moving on to Michael. Michael's a CPA, and he says, previously, a taxpayer could call into an automated IRS phone line and request tax return and account transcripts for both or both for any tax year filed before 1961. Currently, the taxpayer can only submit a request for tax return transcripts back to 2013, the current filing year plus three more back. However, so it seems account transcripts can be requested back beyond that date. First question is, how many years back can the taxpayer request an IRS account transcript? Number two, how would the taxpayer get tax return transcripts back beyond the 2013 tax year at this point? And number three, how far can the tax practitioner, the CPA, EA, or attorney obtain tax return transcripts?
So there's a couple different things that affect how many years back a taxpayer can request IRS account transcripts. And that is, first of all, is there a balance due on that year? Because when there's no balance due, then the IRS moves that transcript from the master, what's called the master file, to the non-master file. And so when you ask on the phone with ACS for transcripts, they'll say that they don't have them. If you ask them to check the non-master file, they may have them there because they only keep returns for so long in the master file if there's no balance on them. If there is a balance on them, then I think you can go back as far as there are years with balances on them. The second question is, how do you get a return transcript beyond 2013? We haven't had any problem. I usually get transcripts when I'm speaking with somebody in automated collection, and I ask them for transcripts. I haven't had a problem going back beyond 2013. The only rule that I run across is that they say that they can only fax me 10 years worth of account transcripts, that if I'm ordering more than 10 years, that they have to mail it. And so you would think if they can fax up to 10 years worth of transcripts that they can go back 10 years. So that's the limitation that I routinely run across. And how far back can the tax practitioner obtain a tax return transcript? Again, it depends whether or not there's a balance due on that year. But I would say at least 10 years.
All right, Norman. Thank you very much, Michael, for that question. Hope we clarified that for you. Moving on to Gardner. Gardner asks, how long after the statute of limitation expires on collection can the IRS collect from a lien? Can you force the IRS to cancel a lien after the statute of limitation expires on all collections? Or at their discretion, can they keep the lien until the property is sold?
Okay, so if there's no tolling event, then the tax lien and the collection statute run concurrently and expire at the same time. So if there's no tolling event, then 10 years after the date of assessment, the tax becomes uncollectible, and the lien is what's called self-releasing. On the face of the lien, it says this lien expires on such and such a date if it's not renewed. And that date is 10 years from the date of assessment. The date that the IRS has to renew the lien is starting a year, there's a window starting a year before the lien expires until 30 days after the lien expires. So the IRS has a window of a year and 30 days. But the IRS can only renew that lien to protect the IRS from a tolled collection statute. So it only tolls the collection statute and the lien for as long as there's been some event that's prevented the IRS from collecting. So while the original lien was self-releasing, the renewed lien is not. And so the IRS is supposed to release that renewed lien when the collection statute finally expires. And if they don't, you can call it used to be called the lien desk. Now it's called the advisory group. So you can call the advisory group and say, I need this lien manually released. The collection statute has finally expired. What was your other question? Oh, how long can they keep the lien? They can't keep the lien once the collection statute has expired, and they have to release it, and it's not up to their discretion. It's both the Internal Revenue Manual and the Internal Revenue Code has strictly says that the IRS shall release the lien. It doesn't say may, which would be discretionary. It says shall, which means that it's mandatory once the collection statute has expired. And again, if there's been no tolling event, then the collection statute and the lien expires at the same day.
All right, Gardner, hopefully that clarifies it for you. Moving on to John is an EA, and he's asking, is there a time limit to submit an audit reconsideration with additional documentation after the audit case closure and assessment? If it is still active, what IRS forms do we need to complete for the reconsideration, or do we have to request an equivalent hearing with appeals?
So there is audit reconsideration, but the timing depends on where you're at with the audit. So, for instance, with the first letter submitting the proposed audit report is a 30-day letter, and like it sounds, you have 30 days from the date of that letter submitting the proposed audit report to appeal it, either with the auditor, who's usually a revenue agent, or the auditor's manager. If you haven't appealed it, or you appealed and lost it at that level, then a notice of deficiency is issued, and a notice of deficiency comes with a 90-day letter, which gives you 90 days to appeal it in United States Tax Court. If you miss that 90 days, then that notice of deficiency has become final, and the tax court does not have jurisdiction to hear your case. So at that point, if you want to present new evidence and appeal that audit, you would need to submit an offer doubt as to liability, and you would submit the additional documentation with your offer, and the form for that offer is a 656L, and the amount of the offer is the amount that you say that the true liability is, and a doubt as to liability offer has to offer something. It can't be zero. So you may not agree with all the expenses that have been denied or whatever, but you can greatly reduce it, and that offer will be examined by an appeals officer and go back to another auditor, and you could get another bite of the apple that way. And there's no limitation on the time to do that. So if the 30 days have passed and the 90 days have passed, then offer doubtless a liability is pretty much the way to go.
All right, we're going to go ahead and move on with the questions that people have been submitting online. This first question, Norman, you may or may not have the answer to it. If you don't, then what I'm going to do is refer it out to one of our CPAs. But Camille is asking, what are the special employment tax implications for a U.S. company hiring workers in China to do IT programming services?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to give you false information, so no, I don't know that.
All right, Camille, so yes, that's going to be what I'm going to do is I'll submit that question to one of our CPAs and try to get you a response. It probably warrants a call, but we'll follow up with you directly. Next one was from George. When you were talking about substitute for returns, Norman, he asks, if we file a return to the ASFR to replace an SFR, can it then be discharged in bankruptcy?
Yeah, that's the hot question, and the answer is, it depends, and the reason I say that is because even though bankruptcy law is federal law, it's treated differently in different circuits. And so, like, for instance, in California, we're in the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit has laws that are from case law that are different from case law in other circuits. And unless it's the case has been brought before the United States Supreme Court, in which they rule, and then the law becomes standard across the whole country, case law can vary circuit by circuit. And so some circuits say that an SFR, once the IRS has prepared an SFR, that anything else that the taxpayer submits after that is not a true return and therefore not dischargeable in bankruptcy. Other circuits say that it depends on the circumstances and that they look at the big picture and make their determination on questions about whether why didn't the taxpayer file a return timely? Why did they file a return only after the IRS had already gone through the effort of preparing a return for the taxpayer themselves? And they look at what's called the totality of circumstances. And sometimes they can determine that, yeah, it should be discharged because for good reason. But if you're looking at bankruptcy and you have SFRs, you need to be prepared to have a battle with the IRS on whether or not the subsequent returns filed by the taxpayer are actual returns and that whether the liability is dischargeable or not. And one thing you would look at would be the difference between the SFR and the taxpayer's prepared return. Did the prepared return, did the taxpayer owe more or less than the SFR? And things like that. So it's very tricky and it's been changing. And I don't think any return prepared by a taxpayer after the IRS has submitted an SFR can be deemed automatically discharged. It's always going to be an uphill battle.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Moving on to the question that Louise posed here. She's a member, and this is when you were speaking about the in-business offers and compromise, Norman. So under the in-business offer and compromise you were discussing, does that include if the taxpayers shut down and reopened under a new federal employment identification number? Am I correct that the IRS would look at the new company while considering OIC for the old company or any other solution? And she's referring to payroll taxes.
Yeah, so if there's a new company, then the new company shouldn't have that tax, shouldn't have that payroll tax liability unless they've been assessed it, because the IRS is under the assumption that the new company is really just the old company in disguise. But the trust fund recovery penalty would still be, if it was assessed against one of the responsible persons, would still be collectible. So I'm not sure what you're asking, because in an in-business offer, the original company would still be in business. So if they haven't been, then it really wouldn't be an in-business offer. And it seems like the offer would be better served if it was submitted by the responsible person to an offer as to the trust fund recovery penalty.
All right. Louise, I sent you a chat. If you want to discuss a little further, we do have a few minutes. If you're available to speak to Norman, we can do it now online. Waiting your response, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next question. Is by Adam. Adam is asking, what is the likelihood of a client getting an offer in compromise if he has already agreed to an installment plan, but now realize that he was not thinking when he agreed to it with the IRS on the phone?
Yeah, so you could submit an offer, and there could be a change circumstances as to the numbers that were submitted for the installment agreement, but you'd have to look at the see if the numbers are the same or not. And then secondly, the IRS could take the position of how much are you offering as opposed to how much would they collect if the installment agreement ran its course. So whether or not the installment agreement would be a full pay installment agreement where based on the monthly payments, the total amount of the tax liability would be paid within the statute on collection, or whether or not it's a partial pay installment agreement and the tax that that does not get paid in the installment agreement would be uncollectible when the CSUD expired. So in that sense, a partial pay installment agreement is kind of the best of both worlds between an installment agreement and an offer, because you're making payments and you don't have to come up with a lump sum payment like you do on an offer, and yet at the installment agreement doesn't toll the statute. So when the statute expires, whatever tax is owed is forgiven. So I would look to see whether or not it's a partial pay or full pay installment agreement and determine whether or not you want to submit an offer.
All right, Adam, hopefully that answers your question. So, Norman, going back to Louise's question about the in-business offer, she is available to come online, so I'm going to bring her on. Give me one second. All right, Louise, I've gone ahead and unmuted you. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we're hearing you fine.
Okay, great. So, Norman, what I've got is I have a client who, you know, basically we're working on an OIC. We shut down the company. They have reopened under a new entity, new EIN. And, of course, I have to kick them because they've already blown compliance. I'm assuming that before I submit this original OIC under the old EIN, I've also got to make sure they're in compliance under the new EIN.
Well, but the new company isn't the party that's submitting the offer.
Correct.
So why would the new company need to be in compliance?
And that's what I'm asking. That's my question. You know, before I go through, you know, the brain damage of finishing the OIC, if clients, if I got to do more work first, I was just trying to get a heads up.
But the thing is, why would, but it's, see, it's not an in-business offer because,
okay.
because the original company's not in business.
Okay, great. That's kind of what I was trying to verify.
Okay, and if the original company has no assets, then is really not collectible against.
Right, okay.
I would be more concerned about whether or not the owner was ever assessed a trust fund recovery penalty.
Not yet. So.
Oh. Okay. So when that happens, that's when it's going to hit the fan because they're going to look whether or not the new company is really a new company or just the old company in disguise. And then secondly, they're going to look at the owner's capability based on the offer.
Okay.
I guess I would wait to see whether or not the trust fund recovery penalty is assessed against the owner or not.
Yeah, in this case, we're not even close to that. So, okay, that's what I was.
Remember, the IRS only has 3 years.
Oh yeah, we're 4 months into it, so.
Okay.
Everything just got filed, so.
Well, just keep your fingers crossed.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
All right, Louise. Thank you very much for that. All right, guys. We appreciate everyone attending. This is going to be the end of it for this month's Practitioners Forum. As a reminder, we do have the rebroadcast for tomorrow's live event. I've gone ahead and pushed the link. I'm going to stay on a few minutes after the event. So if you have any other questions, please go ahead and ask those directly, and I will do my best to answer them. If not, we welcome you guys to join us again next month. Again, next month is October 3rd is our next Practitioners Forum. Please go ahead and register. You should see that on our course calendar now. I hope you guys took a few things here today. We appreciate all your questions and continue to send them our way, and we will address them next month. Thank you very much one more time. Hope you guys have a great rest of your day.